The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Yeah, every Friday we invite somebody into Studio 10 and ask them to guide us through the soundtrack to their lives. And today's the turn of songwriter Phil Coulter. Good afternoon, Phil.
Hello, Ray.
It's always handy when somebody has a biography out.
I thought it would make life easy for you, Ray. I wrote a book specially.
Especially for soundtrack. Thank you very much. You didn't write on our behalf. You wrote it on the advice of Eamon Dunphy, as it happens.
Yeah, I've been talking about it for a long time. I think I was first approached to write a memoir maybe 20-something years ago, but it's one of those things you just keep kicking the can down the road. And I think it was Dunphy who said, Phil, you better start on this while you can still remember stuff. Because, you know, I'm 77 years of age, so, you know, I'd be forgiven for forgetting the odd detail, you know. But I'm glad it was a big project, right? It was a big project, but I'm glad I did it now. I sort of got the monkey off my back.
Because in reading it, I can understand how big a project it was, because it is just dense with detail.
Mm.
Yeah, well, and you've done so much.
Yeah, I mean, 55 years in the music business and 77 years on the planet, you know, gives you scope to do quite a few things, you know. And I've been fortunate, that I've made a living from my talent, which is a gift from God, as you'll appreciate. And to have been, you know, I haven't allowed myself to be kind of boxed off into any particular area. For example, Ray, if you know, during the Eurovision period when I had all the, you know, the success of Puppet on a String, yes, Congratulations, all kinds of everything, Twat, etc. If I had then thought to myself, right, I'm a Eurovision expert, this is what I do, you know, I'd have been dead in the water before very long. Equally so, in that run with the Teeny Bopper Act, you know, the Bay City Rollers and Kenny and yes, Slick and all, if I had thought, this defines me now, again, you know, you'd have been dead very much longer.
I'd say there are very few people in the music business who have worked with the breadth of people that you've worked with. Like, you mentioned them already there. Mm. Bay City Rollers to Van Morrison now, how different could they be?
And throw in Luke Kelly in the middle,
yes,
of that as well.
Sinead, yeah, O'Connor, yeah, the Dubliners, Planxty.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the trick is, I've been asked often about, you know, the longevity of the career. And as I give the answer in the book, I turn up for work on Monday morning. That's my job, you know. And so when you've got that attitude, you know, you've got to view each project. Don't let yourself get stale. Don't allow yourself to be boxed off in one particular area or another. And I mean, all of those that you mentioned, I took them all as a great challenge, as a great, you know, an adventure.
Can I ask you this? Because, as I say, it's dense with detail. You've always been very busy for the 55 years we've been working. Was there a moment, was there any lapse period? Was there a period where, you know, things weren't, the phone wasn't ringing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty of them. I mean, I think one of the great put-downs amongst songwriters is, he hasn't been a songwriter long enough to have a cold period, because we all get cold periods. Uh-huh. We all get blocked. You know, I've had my fair share of those, of course. And I think there was one kind of bleak period when after the Teeny Bopper thing, when I finally thought I'd run out of road. You know, I'd had a big, big run with the Bay City Rollers, number one in America, huge international success. We had a stable then. Kenny had a bunch of hits with them. Mm. Slick. And when that kind of sheen came off that for me, that was a kind of fallow period, you know, because I made the decision that I can't do this any longer, because I've lost my mojo, you know. That's one particular area, Roy, where you have to, if you're competing in the singles chart, you need to have your finger on the pulse. You need to know what's going on, you know. So I graduated out of that. I mean, at this stage, I have no desire to get into the ring with Beyonce, you know. I mean,
Or Ed Sheeran.
No, I think he's one of the saving graces amongst the singer-songwriters. He's one of the guys that I would definitely applaud.
Would you? Yeah, and work with him if he asks. Now, sure. So we'll more about the career and on, but back to the beginning.
Okay.
It's a very good place to start, as the song goes. So it was, because of the book, I have the exact details. It was February 19th, 1942. You were born to Philip and Agnes Coulter.
Yep.
At home or in a hospital?
In hospital, the City and County Hospital in Derry. The fourth of five kids. I was the second youngest. I had two brothers and one sister ahead of me.
And they had named a baby Phil already, had they?
Well, I think what happened was that the firstborn in our family was a Philip, the kid who died with diphtheria. And funny, I only realised, you're not going to believe this, right, but I only realised in writing my father's journal, I hadn't even realised that he'd kept a journal. It was my older sister who had held on to it, and that proved to be like a really golden source of information for this project. And I didn't realise that the first kid was christened Philip. My da is Philip. His da was Philip. So Philip Coulter is a name that kind of through the generations. But he was christened Philip Michael Coulter. I wasn't aware of that. I took Michael as my confirmation name with no input from my folks at all. Right. It was just a name that I fancied. So I thought that was a great coincidence. And maybe when I came along, my parents hadn't been aware of the fact that they'd lost the first Philip, that I would inherit the Philip name.
Yeah. And as you got older, did that mean a lot to you that you were given the name that had been sort of used before, if you like?
Not really. I mean, I knew that the Philip was a name that was going down through the generations. Yeah. And in fact, I called my first son Philip as
yes.
well. Yeah,
it's a lovely thing.
Yeah, I think it is.
And there's a nice ring to Phil Coulter as well, doesn't it?
I was never Phil until I went into the music business. Right. My mother refused up until the day she died to call me Phil.
I was Philip.
Always Philip. Oh yes, that was the polite way. Yeah. So it was only when I got into the music business, you know what the music business is like, I became Phil. Yeah.
Well, I'm Raymond at home.
There you go. Yeah. Same thing.
I like the ring of Raymond. Yeah. So it was. You weren't. Did you move to Ballaghy or?
No, my parents. My dad was a cop in the RUC, so his first station was in inner city Belfast, which I'd say wasn't a bag of laughs. Then, when he married my mum, I think there was a regulation within the RUC, which was full of regulations, you can imagine, that once you get married, you moved to another station, and they sent my dad to Ballaghy, and he didn't even know where it was. He had to look it up on a map to see where Ballaghy was. Ballaghy, which latterly has become famous as the home place of Seamus Heaney and producing GAA players for the Derry County team, etc. But back then it was like, really was a backwater. I've often thought that, so they moved anyway, they moved to Ballaghy, and the first child was born in Ballaghy. Then, from there they moved to Derry. Thankfully, nothing against Ballaghy, but if they'd stayed there and I'd been born in Ballaghy, my only chance to shine would have been on the Gilly football field, and that would have been very poor chance.
That wasn't going to happen.
No, that wasn't going to happen. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, what are your memories? Because from the book, you had a happy childhood, nearly. Yeah. Idyllic, was it?
I wouldn't say idyllic, but it was, I mean, here's the thing. When I look back on the earliest days, it was, when I was born in 42, the war was still on, of course, for another couple of years. So even in the late 40s, when I'd have been then, you know, 6, 7, 8, there was still that sense that the war was not that finished. We still had ration books for some of my young days. There was an air raid shelter on the street outside of our house. And I look back on those earliest days and I see them all in grey or black and white. You know, it was kind of austere, but that didn't stop us. You know, we the air raid shelter was a gift, because for us it was like it could be a fort under attack by Apaches one day, and it could be then a battleship being attacked by Japanese the next day. It was wonderful.
You have memories of the siren going off and taking refuge in the.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You're older than I thought.
I am as old as the hills, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, like, I'm going to play some of your sounds and some of the sounds you've chosen, as in...
Great.
I'm going to play some of your songs and all that sort of thing. So we get to this one first. This is from RTE Radio, and it's the Walton's programme.
Now, may I remind you that you're always welcome at Walton's. Do drop in if you happen to be passing 2-5 North Frederick Street, Dublin 1. As usual, this is Leo McGuire wishing all our friends of Irish music at home in Ireland or across the Irish Sea a very happy weekend. And Walton's last word is, if you feel like singing, do sing an Irish song.
There you go. If you feel like singing, do sing an Irish song.
Oh, yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah.
I remember it well. I'm sure that was part of my, you know, formative years when we were all kids. That Saturday lunchtime, the Walton's programme, if you feel like singing, do sing an Irish song. And Charlie McGee and his gay guitar, and Down by the Glen Side. Listening to all of that, that would be my exposure to all those Irish ballads, you know, from a very early stage. And I'm sure that might have had some kind of an ongoing influence.
And both your parents played musical instruments.
My dad played the fiddle. He was from County Down. He played the fiddle by ear, while my mother vamped along on the piano. Normally in a different key from the one my father was playing. But it didn't really matter. you know, because from them I learned the pure joy of music. Pure joy. That music wasn't just something you studied in college or that you sang at church on a Sunday or performed the annual music festival. It was a living, breathing thing that you shared with people. You know, it was part of the fibre of life.
And that comes through in the book, the joy. And when there wasn't joy, you walked away. And even in the early years when you were studying the piano and your man was a bit of a dictator.
Oh, yeah. That I think my father was pretty smart. We had to practice for half an hour on the piano every day, and I hated it. See, I signed on for learning the piano, thinking that I'd be able to play all those wee tunes that I was learning at school. You know, I was taught by the Christian Brothers, so I thought I could be able to play "Proudly the Note of the Trumpet" is, and all those wee tunes. Then, but when I got to the piano lessons, and "Proudly the Note of the Trumpet" wasn't featuring at all. It was all kind of scales and arpeggios and five finger exercises, and a music teacher with a ruler who was hitting me over the knuckles when I played a wrong note. And I thought, this is not what I signed on for. So. To shorten that kind of half hour that I was supposed to practice, in the good room, the parlour, there was a clock, one of the few good bits of furniture about the place. I think it was a wedding present to my folks, but it chimed in the half hour, and I would put the hand forward so to shorten the half hour by 5 or 10 minutes, so it would chime a bit earlier. That's it now, mommy, I've done my half hour. But I got away with that for a surprisingly long time until one day I broke the clock.
Right.
Game up. Yeah. My father came back off duty and my misdemeanor was duly reported. So I got a thick ear for breaking the clock. And then my father said, if you're not making any headway with this music, we can barely afford these lessons, so let's forget the whole thing, which was very smart. Because if he'd insisted on me going back and get my knuckles wrapped and doing a five-finger exercise, I would probably have gone off.
Could have poisoned it forever for you, yeah.
So by the time I got up to St. Columb's College when I was 11... it was a great lesson to learn. There's no better motivation than when you want to do something. I wanted to learn because I could pick out wee tunes in my right hand, but I'm now figuring, what happens down here with the left? How do you put these two things together?
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, then I was hungry for information, just wanted to learn.
This one is from, I'm looking at it here, it's from 1947. So it's a little bit before you went to secondary school.
Yep, a little bit, yeah. How about him in five?
East is east and west is west, and the wrong one I have chose. Let's go where I'll keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows. Don't bury me in this prairie, take me where the cement grows.
That's nice, isn't it?
Let's move.
Well, that was the first tune I played by ear.
For buttons and bows.
For one good reason. That it's all the black notes, da 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 dee, da dee, dee. It's all the black notes going up. So I got that very easy. That was my first tune. That was my first tune to play by ear. So I have a soft spot for button and bows.
Yeah. Music by Jay Livingston. Lyrics by Ray Evans.
Yeah. Livingston Evans, two of the great songwriters.
It appeared in the Bob Hope and Jane Russell film The Pale Face.
Yep.
And it won an Academy Award for Best Original Song.
You had good taste even as a 5-year-old.
Yeah, see, you knew what you knew. So it was there. The music was always there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose a lot of people could say music was always there, but they don't reach the heights that you reached. So what's the difference, I suppose?
Well, I think there's a bit of a myth about music and talent, you know. There's a myth that because you're talented, that the world owes you a living. Because you're talented, de facto, you deserve to make a living from your talent. Nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, it's one of my old hobby horses, but like, the talent only buys you in the game. It's all the other stuff that keeps you in the game and gets you further down the road. You know, the hard work, the application, the right kind of tenacity to kind of stick in there.
Mm.
So, I mean, the world is full of talented losers who didn't get the memo, you know,
But you mentioned it already, that it's work. And you treat it as work.
For sure.
And you went to work straight out of college.
Yep.
So you'd written a song, Fool in Time, in college.
Yeah.
What was the name of the band?
Butch Moore and the Capital Show.
No, but your band.
Oh, my band, the Glee Men.
Was it Phil Coulter and the Glee Men?
Yeah.
So
because when I was at Queen's, I started, when I went up to Queen's, this is what you have to understand. I was in part of the first intake into Queen's of scholarship boys. Queen's University in Belfast would have been the preserve of probably, you know, the well-heeled and probably Therefore, the privileged class in the north of Ireland, which would be de facto the unionist community.
Yes, you're a Catholic.
Yeah, I was a Catholic. Myself, the likes of John Hume, the likes of Seamus Heaney.
Brian Friel.
We would never have got up to university without a scholarship, you know. So when I went up to Queen's, it was all still a bit kind of, you know, a bit staid and a bit, I thought, a bit square. The only music in the university was like the music society. You know, who were doing like Handel's Messiah and stuff like that. There was a jazz club for guys who were getting very intense about Kid Ory's third period on the trombone, which was just leaving me a bit cold. You know, guys with beards and sandals. You know, that wasn't really for me. There was nothing really that was dealing with the popular music in its widest sense. So I started the Glee Club. I had read about Glee clubs in America, so I thought, what do we need here? First of all, I started a band, then I started the Glee Club, and sort of, I thought, if I'm up here, I might as well enjoy myself, which I did.
And what was happening in the world of music, popular music at the time?
Well, luckily, what was happening...
Rock and roll, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was timing was critical for me and my life and my career, because when I was a teenager is when pop music completely changed. I mean, there were pop songs like How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
Yeah.
Or She Wears Red Feathers and a Hooly Hooly Skirt. And then along came rock and roll, Elvis Presley, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
Just when I was in my teenage years and got completely seduced by all of that. Absolutely. Yeah. And it is, I mean, that's to this day, I still hear Buddy Holly and get a tingle. To this day, when on a late night radio program, some nice DJ plays Elvis Presley singing My Boy, I mean, I still get a buzz.
Your song.
Yeah, my song.
Song by the King.
Not what I ever thought, Ray Darcy, in my little bedroom in a terraced house up in the attic in Abercorn Terrace, listening to my wind-up gramophone of Heartbreak Hotel and Don't Be Cruel. Did I ever dream that Elvis Presley would sing a song of mine? Never.
What an amazing achievement.
Oh, well.
So, Fool in Time, your song, then the Capital Show Band with Butch Moore recorded.
That was the start, yeah.
And that was a hit down south then. And as a result, you got a job as, sort of directly.
In
a sort of a songwriting factory.
Well, it was a music publisher's office. Music publisher, manager, agent, whatever, a man called Phil Solomon. And within... Yeah, I was a kind of musical dog's body. I mean, I thought in my naivety, once I got the job, that I'd be arranging scores for the recording sessions. In point of fact, for the first 6 months, I was arranging sandwiches for the office girls. That's the way it was. I was on the lowest rung of the ladder. Yeah. But you know what? I was learning. I was right in the deep end. And I used to get out of the underground of a Monday morning in Piccadilly Circus and just emerge from the boils of the earth and stand there and just took in all of the lights, the neon signs, the red buses, the London taxis and think, I'm in the music business and I'm in London.
And people had to stand up and take note of Philip Coulter from Derry when this won the Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if one day that you say that you care. If you say you love me madly, I'd gladly be there. Like a puppet on a string.
Is that a trombone?
No,
it's a
bassoon.
A bassoon.
A bassoon. Yeah. When we did the demo of the song and played it to our music publisher Jimmy Phillips, he saw that it had for the Eurovision. We set out to write a song, not that would suit Sandy Shaw. She had a bunch of hits. We set out to write a song that would appeal in Europe. And we set out, having studied the whole Eurovision thing, and that's something which is as true today as it ever was, that the meter starts running from day one. So you've got 4 bars before the song starts. Now, the worst thing you can do is just, like, vamp for four bars on those, and then nothing happens. So you'll note from there, the intro was very important, because it sets up a kind of a fairground kind of a thing. So anyway, Jimmy Phillips, our publisher, says, right, boys, I want you to do a proper demo. You know, I'll give you a good budget to do the demo. So I went home, did the arrangement with the bassoon, etc. So a couple of days later, when we're now a day away from getting into the studio, Bill Martin, my partner, who was not the most musically literate person in the world, said, right, what have I got going on here? Big budget from Jimmy. Have I got trumpets, trombones? And I said, no, got a bassoon. He said, what the fuck is a bassoon? He didn't really know. But that was...
What does it look like? What's a bassoon look like?
A big long thing like that. There's a kind of a bendy kind of a mouthpiece in, and it's like a long upright clarinet.
Ah, yeah.
But a big grown-up one, like 6 foot tall clarinet.
And it gives that... Let's have a listen to it again.
Not an instrument.
It's like
you would
an elephant walking.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's not an instrument you would hear in pop music at all. But I mean, luckily, see, that was the benefit of a classical education and a benefit of having studied orchestration. That was a sound that I knew was not familiar, you know, not used in pop songs, but it would stand out. And in Eurovision, you get 3 minutes to do your business, so you need all the help you can get.
And it won the Eurovision for the UK, Wyoming. In 1967, and you nearly made it two in a row. Probably the best song that never won the Eurovision was Congratulations. Yeah. Definitely the most successfully commercially.
For sure, that's the song, as I keep saying, that has fed, clothed, and educated several of my children. Congratulations, I have a soft spot, of course.
Cliff Richard.
Cliff, who is a real hero, a total hero. I mean, a total professional and an absolute gent. But he did a terrific job on the song, and we were in our seats in the Royal Albert Hall, and the floor manager of the BBC, with a couple of countries to vote, we were 6 points in the lead, and thought that's pretty unassailable because Germany was going to vote. They'll always look after us. We're kind of big in Cliff's big in Germany, so. We were taken out of our seats and brought up to like side stage, ready to go on and receive the award.
No.
Oh, I tell you.
No.
Yeah. Then all of a sudden, I think it was Germany gave Spain 7 votes and none to us or something like that. So we ended up in 1 point behind, robbed at the very final hurdle. Yeah.
But nobody remembers the winner. Well, I definitely don't.
It was a song called La La La, which then rocketed into obscurity.
And you, from the age of 21, you're very much lived and worked in England. Mm. No surprise then that in the 80s you were offered an MBE by Margaret Thatcher. I'm just skipping on here because I'm aware that we're at 52. And so you get a letter marked, from the Prime Minister's office.
Ken Downing Street, from Maggie Thatcher's personal secretary. The Prime Minister is of a mind to recommend you for
the Queen's list.
Yeah, recommend to the Queen, and yeah, it was nice. Sure, it was nice. It was flattering to think they even knew who I was, and flattering to be offered a distinction. But when I thought about it, and it didn't take me too long to think about it, Ray, because, you know, being who I am and where I come from, it just didn't sit very, very comfortably with me.
What went through your head when you were considering it?
Well, first of all, Maggie Thatcher. That was the most important thing. It was from her office. And in simple terms, as simple as this, I thought, well, you know, while that's very flattering, if I accept this, it's tantamount to me saying, I'm on her team and I'm with you, Maggie, and thank you very much. But I wasn't, because I wasn't a Maggie Thatcher supporter. I was anything but. I mean, I'd been horrified by that very Iron Lady stance that she took continually in her term of office, with the hunger strikers, with the miners. You know, she was pretty heartless to me, and she personified the worst kind of right wing Tory to me. And I'm not a right wing Tory, so I thought, no, I don't want to join your club. I'm doing okay without the honour.
And if it was a different Prime Minister.
If it had been Tony Blair, I might have thought about it.
Right.
Know? I might have thought.
Because other Irishmen, I'm thinking Bob Geldof, I've accepted.
Oh, yeah, and guys from the North, Pat Jennings and lots of other guys in the North. And I don't think any of the less of them for doing it. I'm not saying that my choice was the only choice and the right choice, but I know it was the only choice for Phil Coulter.
Yeah.
You know.
So you feel good about that, as in you've kept your integrity.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, I don't deserve any credit for it. No. I mean, I didn't talk about it. The only time that it ever came out was because I put it in the book, but at the time, I didn't make it public because, you know.
What you also talk about in the book, and you've done so much, you know, that for example, that you've told there probably gets a page and a half, you know, which is a big story.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Ireland's Call gets another page and a half because there's so much to tell, so many stories to tell, so many names to mention. So Ireland's Call, tell us about that. What happened there?
I was called into a meeting in the IRFU to say that they were finally confronting a situation which had been a little bit uncomfortable, to say the least. They'd been kicking the can down the road on this from the World Cup in Australia, when it happened just in the aftermath of an IRA bomb at the border, which had actually killed one of the squad and maimed another. And it was thought that, given that, you know, feelings were on very high then, that to play the soldier song as the Irish anthem in Australia might have been a wee bit, you know, just
insensitive.
Insensitive. Right. So some genius came up with a recording of James Last playing The Rose of Tralee, and that was played at the Anthem.
Instead.
And you don't, I mean, it's a great tune, but doesn't encourage people to go to war to the tune of The Rose of Tralee.
So not exactly the
happy. That was an all-time low. So I think that's what probably concentrated their thinking. Then they asked me if I could come up with a sporting anthem that could be comfortably sung by players and supporters like Billy from the North and the South, because the fact is that in the squad, traditionally, there's always been players from the North.
Yes, and different traditions.
When you talk about players from the North of Ireland, you're talking about people from the other tradition, because in nationalist and Catholic schools in the North, the sport would be soccer or GAA. Now, there are some Catholic schools that play rugby as well, but in the main, it would be the non-Catholic and the Unionist schools that produce the rugby players. And the best of them, of course, I represent Ulster, and the best of them then go forward to represent the national team. So there's always a high proportion of... You just have to go to Lansdowne Road to hear all the Northern accents. You know, it's been a big, big thing in the North for a long, long time. So the IRA, if you finally thought they should, you know, reach out. I think this was in an era of hands across the border and all-inclusiveness and all those were the buzzwords. So I was asked if I could come up with the song. I did. I mean, I took a long time to get it right, but I told them this is not going to be accepted off the bat. You know, there's going to be a lot of begrudgery. There are going to be conspiracy theorists that think that this is some kind of northern plot, you know. The counter-argument from them was, the crowd, they all sing The Fields of Athenry. I said, yeah, but it's been a hit like forever and a day. Yeah. It's been sung in every pub in the country. We're trying to get them to sing a song they don't know. And number one, as a race, we don't like to be told what to do. And we certainly don't like to be told what to sing. So it was, I knew it would be an uphill struggle, but thankfully.
They chose you as a Northern Catholic.
Well, I think it was probably one of their smarter moves. I think it was a strategic move. Because why? Because I'd be sensitive to you know, the feelings of the Unionist community up there. And, you know, you would have to avoid, you know, I mean, and even lyrically, I mean, the tune came readily, you know, within a couple of weeks. Then how am I going to say, like, the 32 counties are, you know, united, we'll go forward, and the Green, it's got to be a wee bit of sensitive. So I danced around that for a long time before I came up with the Four Proud Provinces.
Four Proud Provinces. We've spliced the original recording with Andrew Strong on lead vocals together, and see if you recognise the second bit of this. This is the first bit, sorry. Oh, I played the wrong one. It's called Merge. Sorry about that. Where are you? Where is Merge? It hasn't appeared there. Ah, there you go. Sorry about that. Sorry about that, Phil.
Okay.
That is Andrew Strong.
That's Andrew.
Yes, it is. And now I gave away the... I want to talk to you about that, because that was 2007, Ireland play England in Croke Park.
Yeah.
Historic day for sport and for the island of Ireland. And I want to talk to you about where you were, how did you feel and all that. We just have to take a quick commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we're speaking to Phil Coulter. So, Ireland's Call, it's 20 years old.
At least.
And
more.
And you say that it was that moment that it was a pivotal moment.
I think so, yeah. I mean, it was important for all sorts of reasons, but important for the song as well. I think that was finally the time that kind of begrudgery was silenced, you know, because the decibel level, we were all very relieved at the respect that was shown for God Save the Queen. Then Oura na Mhéin, rightly so, the decibel level went through the roof. But then Ireland's Call just...
In Croke Park.
Just took off, yeah. That was, you can't quantify, you know, you can't, as a songwriter, you can't quantify that kind of feeling in terms of record sales or chart positions or anything else. Those are the kind of moments that make you thank God.
And you were there in Croke Park?
Yeah, yeah.
Who was with you?
Two boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other feeling was, it's nice to think as well, that's one of the kind of gifts of being a songwriter, that, like, when you fall off the perch, with a bit of luck, there might be a few of your songs that hang on, you know. So the feeling that when my two lads have been going to a rugby game, when I'm dead and gone, they'll still be singing Ireland's Call.
Yeah.
You know, that's a kind of nice feeling.
really enjoy the book, and like there's very sad stories about Sid and Brian, and there's lovely moments in there when Sinead O'Connor recorded Scorn, Not My Simplicity, and you knew it was, you stood there for a few minutes after in silence, the two of you.
I was sitting.
I was sitting
at the grand piano here. Sinead was over there in the vocal booth. We did a run through just for levels for the engineer, and then we said, okay, let's try it. She sang and I played. No other instruments, just the two of us. When she said, oh no, oh no, oh no, she stood where she was, I sat where I was. The engineer, who would be a veteran engineer of my own, just knew not to say a word, not to press a button or break that silence, because we just instinctively, both of us knew something doesn't happen every day in a studio, Ray, I can tell you. Just was something magical happened.
As he stands alone and watches children play a children's game, simple child, he looks almost like the others, yet they know he's not the same. Scorn not his simplicity, but rather try to love him.
There you go, Sinead O'Connor, her version of Scorn Not My Simplicity.
I mean, how lucky am I to have two of the best voices this country ever produced to sing that song? Sinead and Luke Kelly. And miles apart, but two very different versions, but both magical to me.
I've one gripe with the book.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a get-out-of-jail clause for you, mm-hmm. where obviously things happened and you say, I can't remember much of that. I take that as code for too wild to remember any of it.
Could be.
Please let Phil Coulter know that he will never ever know the joy that his music has brought to many children I worked with in special education. Many hours of happiness were danced with pure joy. That's Olive. Phil is one of my piano heroes. I travelled to New York. This is somebody else. Travelled to New York, met up with my American family and went to see Phil in the Lincoln Center on St. Patrick's night. My son was in his band at the time. Amazing night. What a talent and a gentleman. Ask him, what is it about Derry people? Why did it breed so many stars?
Mm.
Not a long answer now, but you mentioned like even the people who just went to your school, Brian Friel, John Hume.
And there's always been music's always
Paul
been in
Brady.
The Derry area.
Forgot to mention Paul Brady.
Paul Brady, sure.
Phil Coulter is a joy to listen to. Like Phil and most kids in Ireland, I took a confirmation name, but why? What was the idea behind confirmation? I don't know the answer to that. Bruised, Never Broken is Phil's autobiography. And it is an autobiography. Nobody ghostwrote it for you. And your voice sings through in the whole thing. Been a real pleasure, Phil.